You know, it's interesting now when you look at the election that the people who are doing the absolute best advertising for the Democrats is the Lincoln Project, which are disenfranchised Republicans. And they're really, because, and it's, you know, people like Rick Wilson was a pit bull on the other side. You know, he was the one who would create all these really negative campaign ads for Republican candidates. And now he's doing it for the Democrats. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of catching up to do in terms of realizing that these bad actors are, you know, are years ahead in terms of using these technologies. I think whenever I thought about it, I always thought about people who were like me and, you know, foolishly thought that it was, you know, people like me that thought like me would be the people that would be using this technology to magnify their power and the whole notion of democratizing technology, and, you know, never thought about like what, you know, countries like Russia and, you know, other folks would latch onto this stuff and use it in very powerful and effective and destructive ways.
Gareth Branwen is a man with many talents and many interests. In this episode of the Plutopia Podcast, we explore those interests and discuss the current state of cyberculture, the internet, and the maker movement.
Hey everybody, welcome to another Plutopia Podcast. Today we'll be talking to Gareth Branwen. Gareth and I have known each other for a long time. He contributes regularly to Boing Boing, to Adafruit, and to Hackspace Magazine. And he publishes a weekly newsletter, Gareth's Tips, Tools, and Shop Tales. He's also working on volume two of his best-selling 2018 book, Tips and Tales from the Workshop. He's a well-known writer and editor and a pioneer of both online culture and the maker movement. He's also a former editorial director of Make and was a contributing editor to Wired for 12 years and a senior editor of Boing Boing when it was a print zine. He's also the author or co-author of over a dozen books, including The Mosaic Quick Tour, which was the first book about the web, The Happy Mutant Handbook, which was a Boing Boing thing, Mischievous Fun for Hired Primates, and The Lazy Man's Memoir, Borg Like Me, and other tales of art, Eros, and embedded systems. And just to start here, Gareth, well, hello, we're happy.
Hey guys, how's it going?
I'd like to start with some history going back to your life in the commune and your relationship with Patch Adams. Could you talk a little bit about that stuff?
Oh yeah, sure. Well, yeah, the commune that I lived in was called Twin Oaks, which people might be familiar with. It's one of the better known U.S. communes, which has been around since I think it was 2 years ago, they celebrated their 50th anniversary. I was there for that, which was lovely. So I moved to Twin Oaks when I was 17 years old. I lived there for 6.5 years. And it's pretty much where I went to college. I went right from high school to Twin Oaks. And so I sort of got my education in life, the universe and everything from Twin Oaks. When I was growing up, I was a huge Whole Earth Catalog fan. And so I really felt like I got to sort of like live the Whole Earth Catalog. I got to do, you know, gardening and animal husbandry and arts and crafts and all the rest of the whole systems and all the things that I had read about in Whole Earth, I got to do at Twin Oaks. And then while I was at Twin Oaks, I met Patch Adams, the guy that they made the movie about, starring Robin Williams. And he really helped me. I have ankylosing spondylitis, a form of very severe arthritis, which my doctor just recently defined as a miserable recalcitrant disease, which I just thought like, yeah, that pretty much sums it up. But anyway, so he really helped me out, I thought. A friend of mine met him at a conference and introduced us. I spent some time with him. And so he was trying to get Gesundheit, his organization, off the ground. And so I decided to move with my then wife to his organization in the DC area, Arlington, which is where I still live, and start helping him out doing organizational stuff, graphic design, putting out a newsletter, all that kind of stuff. And in some ways, I think that eventually helped contribute to him getting a book deal, which then was the movie with Robin Williams was based on that book, sort of. So that's the sort of trajectory of that. And I lived there for 10 years with Patch.
Do you miss living in a commune?
I don't. I don't at all. you know, I'm a very much a people person, so I miss a lot of the social interactions of that, but I don't miss the domestic politics and all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah. No. I know that sort of thing can be really political.
Yeah, and it just becomes exhausting, you know, just to get anything done, you've got to go through a committee. And it's just easier and maybe a little lazier to just, you know, you have yourself and your partner, you have one person or a small family, and that's kind of enough to negotiate. I did want to, at one point, get really interested in co-housing. I love the idea. I think co-housing is what a lot of us are going to end up doing in our dotage.
Yeah, that's more community than commune, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you have your own space, but there's communal space, and there's a communal kitchen a lot of times, and there's community gardens. And so, yeah, you sort of get the best of both worlds.
Most people don't even know their neighbors these days.
Yeah, oh, God, it's terrible. I mean, as much as I'm a commune person, I mean, I lived in community for 20 years or whatever, I barely know my neighbor, so I'm terrible at that as well. We actually have a nice little community here in Arlington, the little neighborhood that I live in. They do all kinds of activities, and there's a community garden and stuff. And just shamefully, I've never participated in any of it. So
not too late to start.
Well, there's that. Absolutely. Well, then now might not be a good time.
Actually, that's a good point.
Maybe next year.
This COVID thing has put a damper on things, I guess.
Oh, yeah. It's been extraordinary. It's just surreal.
So it sounds like you kind of got started on the media design kind of thing when you were in the commune, but how did you get into digital culture?
That's actually an interesting story because of my obsessive love of all things Whole Earth. I got all the Whole Earth catalogs, I got Whole Earth Review, and then as you might remember, they got a really big contract to put out a Whole Earth software catalog, and then as part of that, I think at the time it was one of the largest publishing advances ever. And they used that, if I may have this wrong, but I think this is correct, that they used some of that money to start Whole Earth Software Review, which was this magazine, which of course I instantly subscribed to. And I read a review in there by Stuart Brand about a software. Oh God, now I can't even mind something. It was like a brainstorming software that
mind map kind of thing.
Yeah, well, not really mind because it wasn't visual. It was just a sort of sophisticated outlining program, basically. And I read this review and I just thought, oh my God, I need that so bad. I really want that. And so I went to Patch. I was living at Gesundheit, and I convinced him that we needed an Apple IIe. To put our mailing list on, because I ran the numbers and I found out that sending out the newsletter mailing list for labels and the printing, everything that we were doing was costing us so much money that we could pay off the investment of a computer in like a year and a half or whatever. So,
is that assuming that you would just email it to everybody?
No. God, this was way before any of that.
Yeah,
that
didn't
involve any of that. No, it just, we printed out labels. We went to a database service, and then we would send on 3x5 cards. You'd give them the latest subscribers, and then it'd spit you back a thing on a roll of labels that we didn't physically affix to the newsletter that we had printed someplace else. So I convinced him that, no, we can do all of the database stuff ourselves. So I went out. He was just so great with stuff like that. He'd go, yeah, sure. And then I went out the next day to a computer store here and bought an Apple IIe. And then it wasn't immediately, but the one that gets me is like a few months later, we were running out of memory and, you know, you have to put everything on floppy disks. And so I convinced him that we needed to get a hard drive. And I got this thing called the Apple Cider, which was a 10 megabyte, which I remember telling people, like, I can't remember now, like, how many filing cabinets of information that represented.
Yeah, that was back then.
Yeah, I was like, you could drive a truck into this thing. It's so huge. There's so much space on here. You know, I had read somewhere like how many floppy disks it was equivalent to, how many filing cabinets. But the thing was so heavy. I can't remember how much. It cost a lot of money. I don't even remember. I think it was like over $1,000. It might have been like $3,000. I don't know. I'm terrible with numbers, but you barely could pick it up and get it on the desk. It was so giant and heavy. And just the idea that now 10 megabytes, you know, is just a laughable amount of space. But anyway, so I did that for a while. And then a friend of mine worked at the Futurist magazine. And no one at the Futurist, they were so behind in terms of their technical savvy, ironically enough, that I was like a computer genius relative to the folks who were involved directly in the Futurist magazine. And so he said, hey, would you be willing to do a monthly computer column? And so that's basically how I became a computer nerd and started really following, you know, beyond just my own needs, just started following the computer space in general. And then I started writing more things about the different computer applications. And then, of course, when the internet really started to take off, and then I joined the Well. I joined the Well in like 1987, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. You were talking about sort of how you went in through the Whole Earth Software review. And I had no interest in computers myself. And I thought, why the hell are they doing that? Because I was also like you, I was I was very committed to Whole Earth and Coevolution Quarterly and, and all of the stuff that they were doing and printing. And then they started the software thing. And I just thought that was kind of weird that it didn't really connect. And it wasn't until they started the Well and I found out that I could like go somewhere and talk to those people. You know,
yeah,
that's what really got me into it. And I remember having to go get a bank loan to buy my first computer.
Oh, yeah. My second computer. So the second computer I got, then I convinced Patch, although I did this for my own graphic design business. But I didn't get money from him, but I had to get a loan to go get a Mac SE, a LaserWriter. And then I think it was Word, Microsoft Word 2 or whatever, and maybe PageMaker 2. I can't remember. But yeah, I spent $11,000 on that package.
So amazing.
Yep.
So was it? So you were totally in the Mac world. You weren't using PCs at all.
Not in the beginning, but then when I started, you know, fast forward to the early 90s. No, it was like the mid 90s when I started Street Tech, my tech review website, hardware website, streettech.com. And by then I tried to make sure I had everything. I had like a real nice sort of computer lab set up, and I had a PC, a Linux machine, and a Mac or several Macs. So I really wanted to know everything. I wanted to know the entire space. But yeah, in the beginning, I came in through Macs, and I pretty much have stayed devoted to Macs. But although I've sort of lost a lot of my sort of early evangelical fervor for Apple. As I guess everyone has. I saw Mark Fraunfelder in his latest newsletter, The Magnet, he talks about switching finally, you know, sort of, because yeah, when I met Mark, he was a PC guy. And then he switched to Max and stayed with Max until recently. And now he switched back.
Yeah, I have both. For many years now, I've always had a Mac on my right hand and a PC on my left mm-hmm. hand. So that I mean, they do different things differently, I guess. And it's sufficiently, it's sufficiently differentiated that I can make a case for having both.
Right. Yep.
So, yeah. And you said that you joined the Well. Did you, like me, meet Mark on the Well, or how did you get with Boing Boing?
No, Mark and I actually, by the time I got on the Well, and I don't know when he joined, but I think we already knew each other, and it was through Fact Sheet 5.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was doing my zine, Going Gaga, and he was doing Boing Boing. And as you know, when you would get your issue of Fact Sheet 5, I mean, it was just such an exciting thing, that fat zine of zines. And I would go through and read every single review, and the things that looked interesting to me, I'd make a little circle in the margin. And then I'd go back through with a pile of stamps, a pile of envelopes, and a pile of cash. And then I would, you know, subscribe to these different zines that I was interested in, and I would check them off. So it's really cool now when I go back. I still have all my Fact Sheet 5s, and I can see absolutely everything that I ordered, because it all is a little circle in the check mark. But I saw, I think I had done my second issue of Going Gaga. And then I saw Mark, you know, of course, Boing Boing catches my eye because it's a sort of a similar goofy name. And then I read the description. I think, like, oh, my God, this is kind of these are all my interests, too. So and we exchanged zines. I don't think I bought my first Boing Boing. I think I sent him a letter and said, hey, I'd like to exchange zines. And I just recently found the letter that he wrote back. And it's really beautiful because it's perfect Mark. It's a perfect Mark message where it's on a little piece of a memo paper. And then, you know, with his very, very nice engineering handwriting. And then he drew a little one of his Mark cartoons at the bottom. But it was just so cool to realize that right from the beginning, you know, there was Mark fully formed, the Mark that we know and love today.
Oh, yeah, that's funny. He once wrote a letter requesting South by Southwest to give me a press pass. And toward the end of the letter, he told them that they shouldn't be too disturbed if I start to glow in the dark.
So we exchanged the zines, and then we just hit it off immediately. And I used to call them on the phone. This was when they were living in Boulder, Colorado. I'd call and talk to both of them on the phone. And it was just one of those things where we just clicked immediately. And then I think it was issue 5 is the first time I was actually in Boing Boing. They had did a writing contest for a surreal real life event, I think was the theme. Write about something surreal that happened in your life. And I wrote this thing about being on the metro in New York and having like a homeless clown guy get on the train and go around with an empty box. I wrote up that story, and I actually won the contest. And so that was the beginnings of, I got his original artwork for that cover was what I won.
Oh, that's great.
And then from that point on, we just became fast friends. And then I guess when by the time we were both on the Well, we started the Boing Boing conference. And that was it. Yeah. And that's also how I met, like, Are You Serious and my Mondo connection and Wired and all that basically came through the Well.
And Street Tech started at Mondo, correct? Or was
no,
it Jargon Watch?
No.
That was Jargon Watch, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Jargon Watch actually, I wrote a piece in Mondo 2000 called Talk Nerdy to Me, which was about the Hacker's Dictionary and just hacker slang. And then Kevin Kelly called me up and said, hey, you know, I think they'd already put out the first issue of Wired, or maybe that was in production. And then he said, we want to start this column. Would you be interested in doing this, like, you know, hacker slang, Wired culture language column? And I said, heck yeah. So that was the beginnings of Jargon Watch. And I did that for 12 and a half years.
And that was how you got involved with Wired.
Yeah.
So, at Mondo 2000, you had a column, didn't you? What was that column?
Well, yeah, no, and you're right. I had a street tech. I've done this thing like Going Gaga migrated from being a zine to then being a column in Boing Boing. And I did the same thing with Street Tech. Street Tech started off as a website, and then it migrated into Mondo 2000. So I would just, you know, this concept was basically the same, and I just moved it into different media. And so, yeah, I was actually the Street Tech editor of Mondo 2000. And so I did the whole tech column in the beginning of the book. And then I wrote a bunch of articles. I did a bunch of music coverage for them. I interviewed Nine Inch Nails and a bunch of industrial, just strange bands, and wrote other stuff.
So how would you describe the scene we were in back then?
To me, actually, I think a lot of it is, there's a cultural historian, William Irwin Thompson, that has a concept called the corona effect, which is before something is going to, you know, sort of coalesce into something new. There's sort of the corona effect when a star dies, a sort of a flash. And I think that a lot of that stuff that I was into at the time, you know, there was obviously email was just getting started, and there was the zine scene. And I was also really involved in fax networking, which is you get this, it was just like Fact Sheet 5. You get a directory of all these fax artists, and it would be a little description of what kind of work they do. And then if you thought that sounded interesting, you would call up their fax machine, you'd send through some of your art, and then they would send some of their art back. And then there was obviously mail art, all the whole mail art thing, which was very much concurrent with the zine movement. I was involved in all those things. And at some point I realized, like, I think all of those things were sort of like, it's like we could smell the internet about to happen, because all those things ended up just sort of collapsing into the net. All of a sudden, all of those things were the multimedia of the internet, but they all were happening separately leading up to the internet. And same thing with Beyond Cyberpunk, the HyperCard stack that we did, you know, that was basically the web for your desktop. It was Kevin Kelly has called it a mini web. When you had, you know, what HyperCard basically was like mini web. It was a web browser, and it was web-like hypermedia content, but it would just existed on your computer. So again, that was another element of this kind of implosion that eventually all came together as the internet that we know today.
Yeah, hypermedia being like link-based. You could put in links and follow the links and put links within links and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Tim Berners-Lee at one point, I never remember if I get it exactly right, but he defined the World Wide Web as a universe of interconnected hyper-documents. And that's what Beyond Cyberpunk was. It was just a universe on your desktop, but it basically functioned in exactly the same way.
And you worked with somebody else on Beyond Cyberpunk, didn't you?
Well, Peter Sugarman, my friend Peter, a computer programmer who also came from the commune, Twin Oaks, which we had really connected over our mutual love for the Mac. And then when HyperCard came out, we just kept on saying, like, God, there's got to be something cool we can do with this. Like, what do you do with it? Like, in the beginning, no one was quite sure. It's like, it's cool, but what do you do with it? Well, what's a practical application for this that's interesting? And so somebody on the Well one night put up a list of every single cyberpunk book they could think of. And So I looked at that and I thought, oh, this is a great, let's just dump this into HyperCard, you know, make a card for each one of these books, and we'll write reviews, little mini reviews of the books that we've read, and then invite our friends to come in and write reviews of the books they've read, and then we'll just put it back on the well in other places where people can download it, and maybe we'll have a place where people can add notes. And so that was the impetus, and then we told Mark Fraunfelder about it, and the funny thing is about the development of Beyond Cyberpunk is Peter and I were just thinking, like, it's a fun project we can do to just sort of, like, get our feet wet and learn how hypermedia and HyperCard works. And when we told Mark about it, there was, I think there was a miscommunication, and he thought it was like we were actually doing it as a real product, like a real production. And so he took it very seriously and started sending us reviews through fax. He would fax us the reviews. And then, you know, I went to Peter and said, oh, God, I think Mark, you know, Mark thinks this is, yeah, this is real. Do we want to do this for real? And it's like, yeah, sure, why not? And then that became the sort of the core team. And then Jim Leftwick, who is a brilliant industrial designer in Silicon Valley, he joined. And it was really the four of us that really was the core team. And then we had all kinds of other people contribute to it. Are You Serious? And Hakeem Bey and Robert Anton Wilson and Bruce Sterling and Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games sent us stuff. Yeah, like, you know, we have these in Beyond Cyberpunk, we have these little Kata Sutra, which was a Mark Fraunfelder cartoon character, became sort of the mascot of the stack. Well, you know, in HyperCard, they call the program stacks. And so she was sort of the spirit kind of haunting the stack. And periodically she would pop up, a little animation would scoot across the screen. She was on like a little hoverboard, and she would say a statement. And like, gene police, everybody out of the, hey, you out of the pool, or, everyone can, oh God, what was it? There's a bunch of them. They were really great. You can do anything and go anywhere if you look important and carry a clipboard. So there's a bunch of these cute little statements. And most of those, a large majority of those came from Steve Jackson. We put out a call to get some of these statements from Kata Sutra, and he sent us a whole list of them, and we used a whole bunch of them. Power corrupts, but absolute power is kind of cool. That was another one. But anyway, so that was it. So we had this, you know, we created this nexus where all of these interesting people, both people who were at that point rather unknown, and then these already sort of famous people like Bruce Sterling and Steve Jackson. It was just this thing that, because of the internet and because of email, you could just reach out to people, you know, relatively famous people, and say, hey, you want to be part of this? Never expecting them to write back and say yes. But they, you know, pretty much everybody that we asked participated in it, which was kind of astounding, which is why we got things from Robert Anton Wilson and Mike Gunderloy of Factsheet 5 did some stuff. Steve Brown from Science Fiction Eye, which was a really influential cyberpunk sci-fi zine at the time, magazine. He contributed an essay. And so, yeah, it was just this really lovely moment in time in which everything just seemed really easy, and these really exciting things were all sort of coming together. My partner Angela, when I tell her these stories of my past, I'll be telling her this exciting story about, you know, Beyond Cyberpunk or some conference that I went to, and she goes, "What year was that?" And I go, 1993. And almost every single time, it's 1993. And so that year was phenomenal in the sort of birth of cyber culture. Yep.
Gareth, we had mentioned when we were getting started that we had recently aired a recording of a 2014 cyberpunk panel, and you were a participant in that. And in 2020, that's 6 years down the road, where do you stand on cyberpunk? Are you a true believer or an atheist?
Well, I don't know that I would put it on that polarity or whatever, but it's fascinating that you bring that up, because that night was really fascinating. It was interesting because, you know, the panel was me, Chris Brown, Bruce Sterling, and Cory Doctorow. And Bruce was really on a tear. Like, I haven't gone back to listen to it to see how much my memory of it aligns with what actually happened. But, you know, he was just going on about how awful, you know, this sort of cyber world had become, and how sort of the wrong people had gotten the memo. The street finds its own uses for things that, you know, the wrong people were using these technologies. He talked about 3D printing guns. That guy, now I forgot his name, but Cody Pickens, I think was his name, but he's an Austinite. Who, again, if I remember correctly, had been a fan of Sterling's and had talked to him on the phone. And, you know, so I think
it's Cody Wilson.
Cody Wilson, yeah. So I think Sterling had, you know, so a sense of connection with this guy. And then also that was when the guy who had started the, was it called the Silk Road on the dark web? And he had just been arrested for trying to hire someone to hire a hitman to kill somebody using Bitcoin. And then
that's Ross Ulbricht.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then he was talking about a lot of you know, organized crime and now all of these things. And at the time I just thought, like, yes, this is all kind of true, but that's just sort of fixating on the negative. And I felt like the audience was sort of like aghast at just how negative the feed coming from Bruce was. And then, you know, but then ever since 2016, I thought, oh God, once again, he was completely right. Because I think he had gotten in 2000, that was 2014. Is that when that was?
That's correct.
Yeah. He had gotten the odor like way before the rest of us, like he tends to do. That's the world that we were, you know, that we were swimming in, that the rest of us didn't sort of catch up with. Until 2016, when we started seeing all of these, you know, these bad actors who were using the web in really nefarious ways. And yeah, so that's how I see that night. At the time, I sort of felt like, wow, he's doing a lot of talking and no one else is really getting to say much. And he's so dark and negative. He's kind of ranting. I think at one point I even said, Bruce, I'm hearing a lot of, hey, you kids get off my lawn. Cause he just seemed like sort of an old guy who was ranting and raving. But yeah, now I think like he's absolutely was correct.
You may recall who the moderator was of that thing. And he got some feedback from people criticizing him. That was me.
Yeah, that was you.
I got feedback from people criticizing me for not stepping in more to actually, it was Bruce and Corey. They actually got into quite an argument and they sort of dominated the panel. And it was like, well, why didn't you step in there? You know, and it's like, are you crazy? There was no way I was going to step into that. One thing, it was kind of great and very dramatic. And for another thing, I might have got hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think Chris said much of anything the whole time. That's why when I your little pre-interview form, when I fill that out, you know, at the end of my list of things about what's going on in the world and stuff, I said the internet is to blame! ! So that pretty much sums it up for me. I think that not necessarily cyberpunk fiction, but the way in which cyber culture, you know, evolved this world that we live in now. And again, when you mentioned secrets of a super hacker in your interview with Mark Fraunfelder, John. And, you know, I wrote the introduction to that. And I just went back and I reread the introduction, and it is astonishing how naive I was, because I'm talking about this disparity of power that an individual or a small group of hackers can wield tremendous amounts of power, and they can bring down corrupt governments or corrupt corporations, or, you know, it's democratizing technology and communication. And but in no place in that piece did I entertain the idea that bad actors would leverage this technology for, you know, for nefarious, you know, democracy destroying ends. And that's, I think, what's going on in the world. Is I don't think sort of the good actors have kind of caught up yet with the idea that we really are in a mind war now. We really are in a mimetic war, and we on the side of, you know, truth, justice, and democracy, I think, haven't sort of caught up with the idea that we need to be using these tools in the same way. You know, it's interesting now when you look at the election, that the people who are doing the absolute best advertising for the Democrats is the Lincoln Project, which are disenfranchised Republicans. And they're really, because, and it's, you know, people like Rick Wilson was a pit bull on the other side. You know, he was the one who would create all these really negative campaign ads for Republican candidates. And now he's doing it for the Democrats. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of catching up to do in terms of realizing that these bad actors are years ahead in terms of using these technologies. The street finds its own use for things. They have found a use for these technologies. When you look at the small amount of money that the Russian influence operation, what they had to spend in 2016, and with that very, very small investment in a room full of hackers and people, you know, talking on public bulletin boards, they might have brought down, you know, they might have put an end to our, the American experiment. So.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I know one guy who identified himself back then as a cyberpunk. In fact, I was kind of surprised when I realized that people were starting to call themselves cyberpunks, and it was kind of turning into a movement. But today, that same guy is an avid Trump supporter, and I think probably a QAnon guy too. And I think that that's kind of a weird and interesting evolution. I mean, cyberpunk was about power, and it was about, you know, there was kind of like this romantic vision of a few hackers, for instance, being able to take down big power, as you alluded to earlier. But that was completely unrealistic. And we had no idea how unrealistic it was, to your point.
Yeah, I think whenever I thought about it, I always thought about people who were like me, and, you know, foolishly thought that it was, you know, people like me that thought like me would be the people that would be using this technology to magnify their power and the whole notion of democratizing technology, and, you know, never thought about like what you know, countries like Russia and, you know, other folks would latch onto this stuff and use it in very powerful and effective and destructive ways.
Do you think the perception of cyber culture was changed a lot by the influence of Hollywood and mass media in the way that they depicted what they thought cyber culture was or should be?
Yeah, oh, sure. I mean, I definitely think that, you know, and I think even going back to cyberpunk literature, you know, those characters in those books were, you know, they might have been, many of them might have been anti-heroes, but they were kind of sexy anti-heroes. I'm on the cyber culture, cyberpunk and cyber culture Facebook group. I can't remember what it's. Do you remember what that group is called?
I think that's right. Cyberpunk and cyber culture.
Yeah, something like that. But on that group, people frequently will make the comment,
Cyberpunk fiction and culture is what
it is. There you go, yeah. People will frequently make the comment, you know, well, you know, we are living in the cyberpunk, the dystopian cyberpunk now, but it's not nearly as sexy as the cyberpunk in, you know, Neuromancer. And it's like, no, it was not supposed to be, you know, like the thing Mike Pondsmith, the creator of the cyberpunk role-playing game, says cyberpunk was a warning, not an invitation. But I think, as you say, Scoop, that it, you know, as things like that become sort of made sexy and cool, and I think that was what drove a lot of early cyberculture, was the idea that you could be a badass, you know, cyberpunk. I love that image that Mondo 2000 did, and especially now looking at it of the cyberpunk, which was that. Eric Hughes from the Cypherpunks, is he standing there and he's got all the cyberpunk gear on, and
he's,
it's like
Jude's boyfriend.
Yeah, and it's so much stuff, you know, but he's got the leathers on, he's got the mirror shades, and he's got a briefcase full of spy equipment, yeah, so that was, you know, the cyberpunk as this sort of nerd sex symbol.
Yeah, the lesson perhaps is be careful what you wish for, you might get it.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, there's all kinds of arguments about whether cyberpunk fiction was effective at sort of divining the future. And I think in a lot of ways, cyberpunk was extraordinarily effective at sort of projecting what was happening 15 minutes into the future, as they used to say on Max Headroom. And I think basically we are living in the cyberpunk now. We're living in this dystopian world, which has a lot of characteristics that are similar to what was described in early cyberpunk literature.
Yeah, this is making me think about that Billy Idol cyberpunk CD that I know you and Mark and I, to a very small extent, were kind of helping with. We were helping him use the well and get acclimated on the well. And
yeah,
sort of trying to manifest himself as a person who had made that cyberpunk connection.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that was also a thing that it took me a while to figure out what he meant. When I first talked to him on the phone, when he presented this idea of using something that I had written, actually I wrote it on the well originally. He saw it in Mondo 2000, but it was a little attempt to sort of codifying some of the themes of cyberpunk, which other people started calling the Cyberpunk Manifesto. And that's what he called it. He said, I would like to use your Cyberpunk Manifesto to open up my record. But in that phone call, and God, I can't do a Cockney accent. I wish I could, but because, you know, I love his accent so much. But he said, you know, the internet is punk rock. And I just thought, like, that was sort of hollow, kind of rock star platitude. But over time, I realized that what he meant at that time was that the internet was an opportunity for him to really go directly to his fans, which now every celebrity and rock musician and stuff does that on a regular basis. But nobody had done that then. You know, he put out his email address on all of the advertising. He was on the well. He was open to talking to people about his music and say, like, what song, what covers do you want me to do next? And, you know, so now none of that is unusual. But back then there were no musicians that were doing that. So for him, it was a way, and, you know, Mark helped him on the album and doing all the album design. He did the entire album in his home studio, which, again, no one was doing at that time. And so he really is, you know, one of the great innovators of, or, you know, people who, again, saw 15 minutes into the future, whether he knew it or not. But he saw in the internet the ability for him to be able to go DIY and go, you know, connect directly with his fans again and sort of circumvent this giant industry that grows up around any of these rock stars, that he got to, you know, bypass all of that and talk directly to people and do everything himself. So that's what he meant when he said the internet is punk rock. And it was it might have been then. I don't know that it's very punk rock anymore.
Yeah, it's more Madison Avenue now, I guess.
Yeah, or something far more sinister than that.
So as we're getting kind of near the end of our time, but I'd really like to hear how you became a kind of a guru of the maker movement and how you got into all of that.
Well, again, it was through Mark Fraunfelder. Mark, at one point I realized there's a small group of us, you would be included in that, that have gone around to all of these different, sort of migrated through all of these different publications. And so Mark was the editor and the original editor-in-chief of Make. And so he called me up and said, hey, we're doing this magazine, me and Dale Doherty, would you like to be involved in it? And, you know, I've always been a DIY person. I realized at one point that everything I do, you know, living in a commune was DIY culture, and then DIY media with zine publishing, and then DIY technology with hardware hacking and building robots, which I've always been interested in. And so, yeah, I was completely in my wheelhouse. And I really also saw it as a continuation of Whole Earth. So I started on issue 2 of Make and was there the whole time until 2000. I left Make officially in 2012 and then got hired back like a year later as a contributor to the website, and then did that up until 2 years ago. And then through that, I started doing a tips column on Make, the website Make. And then when I left, I thought, I really love doing this. I love doing short form stuff like the Jargon Watch column, which I did. I did reviews. I did short reviews for the Street Cred column in Wired. I'm really attracted to short form stuff again, cause that's a Whole Earth thing. So I started, the tips newsletter called Gareth's Tips, Tools and Shop Tales, which I put out every week on through Review, that, newsletter website, REVUE. I did a book after I left Make too. I did a book basically summarizing the column that I had done for Make called Tips and Tales from the Workshop. I'm very much interested in the stories behind tips. I love that tips and tools, when somebody shares a tip, they often say, oh, I learned this from my dad or my mother or a guy I used to work with, or same thing with tools. And so I try to put those stories into the book too. And that book did very, very well on Amazon. And so I'm in the middle of writing the Tips and Tales from the Workshop, Volume 2. It's pretty much gonna be the same thing, just a collection of really great sort of aha tips of optimizing your time in the workshop and different. I divide it up into, rather than dividing it up into disciplines like woodworking or metalworking or whatever, I have cutting, joining, sanding, finishing. I try to think of the category of the, you know, what you're actually doing rather than the category of the type of making. And then it's interspersed with stories that people have about their tips and tools. So if anybody listening has any great tips, workshop tips, DIY tips, or stories about your time doing DIY work, or tools that you've gotten from, you know, passed down from your dad or whatever, I love this. I just love collecting those stories and sharing them.
What kind of tips have you run across that point to the future of maker culture? Are there any ones that really surprised you?
Well, there's certainly a lot of tips these days related to very cutting edge maker technologies like 3D printing. There's a guy who has a thing called CNC Kitchen, where I love citizen science, people who are doing like really sober, serious science, but as just average folks. And this guy does all kinds of testing of 3D printing and optimizing 3D printing and getting the most, strength and durability and heat resistance and stuff. But it's, again, it's all just him experimenting in his home workshop. So there's stuff like that, that it doesn't surprise me, but I'm really delighted to see people doing that. There's a guy, Ben Krasnaw, who has a site called, a YouTube channel called Applied Science. And he does, like, he's even another level further into really, really serious scientific investigation, but basically what amounts to just a home lab. So those sorts of things. People always ask me, like, what's the next thing? And I'm not really that good at sort of predicting what the next thing is. I can say the one thing with the maker movement, people often would say to me, well, it's in 3D printing, it's cool, but what can you do with it besides just making tchotchkes and what's the practical application of all this making in 3D printing? Well, we saw in response to the COVID epidemic, we saw how people are using 3D printing to print PPE stuff for their local hospital, replacement parts for respirators that their local hospital can't get. And the whole maker, well, not the whole maker movement, but many hackerspaces, makerspaces, and individuals really sort of jumped to the challenge. Like, oh, here's how we can apply this knowledge that we have to do something that's really, basically give back to our local community and do something that could, save people's lives. And so that was really exciting to me because I thought, like, okay, this is what the maker movement has been sort of gearing up for, is some way of really applying this knowledge and these technologies to something that's really beneficial to society. And I think that's happening right now.
So, not to ask you what the next thing is, but what is your next thing?
Well, my next thing is, besides the Tips and Tools book, I've been working on a history of cyberpunk for Adafruit. People can check that out. I put up posts on Adafruit, just adafruit.com on their blog. I put up posts every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday related to the history of cyberpunk. And I'm covering everything: cyberpunk film, cyberpunk fictions, cyberpunk comic books, cyberpunk and its relationship to postmodernism, cyberpunk and how it inspired cyberculture, everything, every angle of cyberpunk I'm trying to explore in this column. So we decided to do that in the lead up to Cyberpunk 2077, which is the game, the video game that's coming out hopefully by Christmas. It keeps on getting delayed, and so I'm not super hopeful about it, but so we've been sort of leading up to that because cyberpunk, certainly because of this game, cyberpunk is going to explode again, however superficially or not. I mean, in the last week, I've seen that there's a cyberpunk energy drink. Nike is doing cyberpunk 2077 shoes. So at least superficially, there's going to be this sort of saturation of cyberpunk stuff. And so we wanted to Phil of Adafruit and his infinite wisdom realize it might be cool to tell people what cyberpunk was and actually is in the lead up to this game, which is going to increase people's interest. And hopefully they'll be interested in the actual, history of the genre of fiction and how it influenced popular, computer culture and mainstream culture. So that's what the column's all about. So I'll be doing that. What's that?
In the 80s and 90s, it was science fiction, but now it's kind of more like a Western, right?
Kind of.
I'm sorry, I think I interrupted you. Were you saying something?
No, the point of the column was to sort of educate people on the backstory leading up to what is likely going to be a hugely popular game in which people will be all jazzed about cyberpunk and cyberpunk shoes and energy drinks. And so we wanted to, you know, inform people about the actual backstory of what cyberpunk is beyond this, you know, obviously what's going to be a very popular game.
Is this a console game?
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm not actually sure like what platforms it's going to be on, but yeah, it's a PlayStation, I think.
I can't wait for the product line to come out. So you can wear the shoes and the T-shirt and drink the drink and get the complimentary arrest warrant.
Well, I have William Gibson sneakers. Did you ever see those, John? Where Gibson started doing design stuff for Buzz Rixon, the men's like sport. I don't actually even know what Buzz Rixon was, besides the fact that they put out his.
I never saw them, but I'm not surprised. I mean, Gibson is sort of like a devotee of fashion.
Yeah,
so I'm surprised they didn't have a whole clothesline.
Yeah, he and Sterling, they very much are designers. I've always seen there's a very much a design. I mean, isn't he a design professor now, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he characterizes it as design critic, but he has definitely been the artist in residence at some design schools and has had design classes and so forth, and he loves doing that.
But yeah, at one point they put out William Gibson tennis shoes, and I just thought, oh man, I gotta have me a pair of those. So I still have them.
I wish I had a pair. Are they still, can you still get them?
I don't think so. I bet you if you can, they're collector's items and they probably cost a fortune.
It looks like they might be available at Self Edge. Nope.
I think I also did a bomber jacket too.
Oh, you know, I think I remember seeing that for sure. Well, so Gareth, this has been a great conversation, and
we could probably go
on for another hour or two if we had the time, but we'd love for you to come back sometime and talk some more.
Oh yeah, I'd love to anytime.
Okay, man, that would be wonderful. So Scoop, do you have anything else?
No, that's it. I just appreciate you educating us on cyberpunk. I'm looking to pick up the game and give it to one of my grandsons, because that'll keep them out of my hair and keep them occupied.
Oh, yeah, you're going to buy it and play it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It does look like it's pretty amazing looking anyway. I don't know what it is that as a game. And Gibson has says it looks like Grand Theft Auto with a cyberpunk skin on it. So he's already weighed in.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all of those console games are like Grand Theft Auto with some kind of skin on them.
Yeah, I have no interest in that kind of gaming. I'm a tabletop person and a role player, but I have no interest in digital game. I mean, my son's a game designer, but I have no interest in it myself.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today.
Come see us again.
Great. Appreciate it.
And we look forward to talking again sometime.
All right. See you.
Follow Gareth's continuing adventures at GarethBranwyn.com or on Twitter as @GarethB2. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at Plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.